reclining on the floor beside Marion's chair, Caleb lying on the settee. Marion, Jamie said, breaking through some idle talk about Caleb's hunting. Sarah said she thought Wallace might not have liked that I was making drawings. Do you think that could be true?
Sarah? Marion said.
The girl in Seattle, Caleb said. Because I always thought he was encouraging, Jamie said. But when I really think about it now, I wonder if he might have been the opposite.
I don't know, Marion said. She hadn't paid much attention to the dynamic between Wallace and Jamie, had been too preoccupied with flying.
Sarah's father offered me a job, Jamie said. I could have gone to live in Seattle. I could have had a whole life there, but I said no. Do you know why?
Why?
She was afraid the answer would be that he hadn't wanted to leave her alone in Missoula. Because his fortune came from meat packing. Jamie laughed, sagged sideways onto one elbow. Of all things, what luck. He grew solemn. I must be a fool. In a garbled torrent, he told the story of meeting Sarah in the park, about her mother and sisters, the big house, the art, the topiaries, the seduction of being praised. When he'd reached the ignominious end, he'd dramatically drained his glass. Brightly, before Marion had gathered her thoughts to speak, he said, "Say, would you dance for me?" He tapped his knee in time with the record.
"What?"
Marion said. "You and Caleb. I'd like to sketch people dancing."
"I'm a terrible dancer, Jamie."
Caleb, though, stood and pulled her up from her chair, brought her firmly into his arms.
"You don't have to give him his way on everything," she whispered.
"What's the harm in dancing?" He turned her. Craning her neck, Marion glimpsed doodled lines in Jamie's sketchbook that did not quite add up to pictures but still resembled dancers. She found herself responding to the feel of Caleb, his familiar smell, earthy and coniferous, so different from Barclay's perfumed musk. Though her feet were clumsy and her body stiff, though Jamie was pouring more moon into his glass, she felt weepy from happiness. When the record finally fizzed and went silent, she stepped away from Caleb, wiped her brow on her sleeve. Jamie had fallen asleep. His head flopped back against the chair, the sketch pad still in his lap. Caleb put on a different record, drew her onto the settee beside him. "Why didn't you visit sooner?" he said. She tried to make up an excuse, but she was too wrung out. "Barclay didn't want me to go anywhere. He wasn't letting me fly for a while. He was punishing me for not wanting a baby."
"For not wanting one or not having one?"
"They're the same thing, at least for now. He shouldn't have been surprised. I always told him I didn't want one, but he has this idea that he knows me better than I know myself, when really he's obsessed with trying to make the real me match his imagined version of me."
Caleb's jaw was tight. "He's a bastard," he said. "Marion." Jamie was awake. He hadn't moved but was gazing at her from the floor, his face haggard. "Will you take me somewhere?"
"What do you mean? Now?"
"Soon. I need to leave here."
"Where do you want to go?"
"Just somewhere else." He drew his knees up to his chest. He'd gotten so thin. "You're gone. Wallace is gone. Caleb's always off hunting. It feels like Seattle is the only thing that's ever going to happen to me."
"Can't you just finish high school?"
"You didn't." She started to formulate some wry response about not everyone getting to marry Barclay McQueen. But before she could speak, he said plaintively, "Please, Marion, I can't stay here." Her model planes still hung from the cottage's ceiling, dusty, the glue showing yellow in places. Everything was as she'd left it,
Jamie had confined his chaos to the house. It was nearly dawn, but she sat in the armchair and flipped through some books. Captain Cook in the South Pacific. Fridtjof Nansen in Greenland. She waited for them to fill her with an eager sense of nascent adventure, but they lay dead in her hands. Before, she'd been certain the world would fall open to her once she could fly. Now she knew she would never see any of those places.
"He'll leave him eventually," Caleb had said after Jamie had gone to bed when they were saying goodbye in the kitchen.
"And then what?"
"Whatever you want."
"It's not that easy."
"I could help. We could buy a plane and take hunters out in it."
"We?"
"Why not?"
He looked intently at her. "We're not like that."
"We could be."
She shook her head.
"He'll swallow you up if you let him," Caleb said.
"It's not the end of the world being swallowed up." But she thought of the crevasse.
"Sometimes I want to grab you and shake you until you see sense."
"Go ahead."
He put on his hat and stalked off into the night. The day Barclay was due home, she returned to Bannockburn. She'd stayed 3 nights in Missoula. From the bedroom, she watched Barclay emerge from the car and Sadler go around to pull suitcases from the trunk. Barclay stared up at her in the window, and she knew he already knew she had flown the plane. It was late afternoon. She sat with a book but did not turn any pages. He burst through the bedroom door like a hot wind. He said,
"Enjoy your trip."
She thought she might brazen it out. "Yes," she said. "I went to see my brother."
"You?"
Earlier, she had inserted her diaphragm in anticipation of his return, armored herself at least in that one way, and when he took her by the arm and jerked her off the window seat, put her on the bed, she was glad she had. He got her trousers down around her ankles, turned her onto her stomach. Face to the quilt, she waited. But he leaned a knee into the small of her back, grabbing her wrists with one hand. He pushed the fingers of the other between her legs, digging and scraping, purposefully, as though in an effort to unclog a drain. He was trying to pull out her diaphragm. "Don't," she said. Inadequate, but what else to say? His knee pressed harder into her back. He seemed calm and intent, as though subduing an animal. His nails scratched inside her. There was a feeling of suction when he finally pulled the cap free. He shifted so he was straddling her, his knees clamping her arms to her sides. He held the diaphragm in front of her eyes and with his thumb pushed the rubber out into an obscene protrusion, stretching it until it tore. Tossing the ruined object to the floor, he undid his belt. When she was a child and had wrestled with Jamie and Caleb, she had fought with her whole body, all her limbs, everything down to her fingers and toes. She'd writhed like a serpent even after she'd been pinned. Under Barclay's weight, she lay still as a corpse. She stared at a pile of logs stacked in the fireplace, noticed how the bark curled up like scraped skin, how the pale, splintery split sides had a faint sheen. She was conscious of fear, but the stronger sensation was of humiliation. To be bare-buttocked and immobilized was excruciating, but the worst of her shame was that she had not foreseen this. There was pain, but it seemed distant, just over some horizon of herself. Barclay didn't take long. He made intermittent gasping sounds, and she absorbed without interest that he was crying. Or almost. She was waiting. That was all. When he was done, he lay heavily on her. Eventually, he climbed off, and she heard him dressing and sniffling, but saw only the unburned logs in the grate. She did not move. Nor did she shift after the door closed behind him. Some notion of washing twitched in her mind, but the effort seemed impossible. Where she was, her lungs continued to fill with air and her heart to beat, and so her situation was apparently endurable. At night in bed, she often imagined flying. She would choose a landscape to pass beneath her, mountains with lakes and rivers, perhaps rolling sand dunes if she was feeling adventurous, or tropical islands in a turquoise sea. Lying there with her trousers still around her ankles, she took off from the ranch, flew west over the mountains, flew until she was over the sea, fell asleep over a sheet of blue. Her second day home in Missoula, she had driven Jamie and Caleb in her old Ford up the Bitter Route, stopped at a broad, flat stretch with no ice. Caleb had been first to plunge into the water. The cold had wrapped around Marion's ribs when she followed, squeezed her malaise from her like spent breath. She and Jamie, in their underclothes, had only jumped in once and run right out again, but Caleb, naked, had splashed and whooped. The third night, she had woken in the cottage to Caleb crouching beside her narrow bed. His face close to hers, his hand resting on her wrist, he had said in a low voice, "What do you think?"
"I can't," she'd whispered.
And he'd waited in silence for a moment and then gone away. As the darkness faded, she had gotten up and walked to the airfield without saying goodbye to Jamie. Now Caleb was beside her again, but he wasn't kissing her. He was shaking her by the shoulder, except as she opened her eyes, it wasn't Caleb, but Kate. Marion reached to cover herself, but a blanket had already been pulled over her naked backside. Out the window, bands of pink blazed among gray clouds. "He sent me to check on you," Kate said. "He said he lost his temper." Marion turned her head away, looked at the logs again. She couldn't summon the energy to be embarrassed that Kate had found her lying exposed.
"Did he do this?"
Kate said.
"Of course he did."
"No, this."
Marion looked. Kate was holding the mangled diaphragm on a handkerchief. She nodded.
"I know what it is, you know."
"Good for you.
I'm sure you think I'm just an old maid."
Ordinarily, she would have been interested in whether Kate was implying experience or just knowledge, but not now, she said.
"I don't think about you."
As an experiment, she rolled onto her side and curled her knees in, holding her breath to keep from gasping at the rawness between her legs. She hadn't moved in hours. She had the sensation of cracking out of a thin pane of ice.
"You don't want a baby?"
"No."
"What are you going to do?"
Marion had not considered the question in practical terms. She had so far avoided considering anything. Again, some thought of washing came to her. She imagined walking into the hottest pool of the Lolo Hot Springs, sanitizing herself like Barrett boiling jam jars on the stove.
"Nothing.
I can't do anything."
"Aren't there rinses and things? Can't you drink something?
Do you have those things here? Because otherwise, I don't know how I'm supposed to get them."
Throwing bitterness at Kate like clumps of mud. Another long silence.
"I might be able to get you another one."
Kate held up the diaphragm.
"If that's what you want."
Marion had already refrozen in place, but she made herself crack loose again, lift up on her elbow.
"You could?"
This small piece of kindness, suspect as it was, nudged her out of her stupor toward a precipice over which could only lie the full brunt of misery. With effort, she sat up. A painful pressure came into her head. A different one settled in her groin, raw and hot.
Kate wrapped the handkerchief around the torn rubber disc, put the bundle back in her pocket.
But if I get you one, you can't let him catch you with it.
He might feel it. Kate looked toward the door.
Maybe it's better not even to try. It might make things worse.
No, please get me one. Please. From where, though?
I have friends in England. They're legal there. But it'll take a while, so you'll have to fend him off, or just keep him from...
Averting her eyes, she made a small flicking gesture with her fingers.
I'm going to light the fire, and then I'll run you a bath.
Why are you helping me?
If you have his baby, we'll never be rid of you.
She crouched beside the fireplace, struck a match. The logs flared and caught. She decided, lying in the bath, that if she simply willed herself not to be pregnant, she wouldn't be. Her body was only a vessel for her will, so why not? Other women simply hadn't been strict and forceful enough within themselves. She could seal her womb against him. She slid deeper into the tub, lay unmoving in the water. Thin rafts of bubbles drifted and broke apart like clouds. And since it turned out she wasn't pregnant, she concluded her will had succeeded. She knew this was not true. She believed it anyway. She resumed her aimless movements around the house and ranch. In April, as a late snow fell, she encountered a bear in the forest, thin after the winter, humped and shaggy, its back dusted with white. The animal lifted its head. The black nose throbbed, nostrils pinching closed as it sniffed the air, examining her scent. She carried a rifle across her back but did not draw it, kept still. With its heavy shoulders, the bear shoved the earth away, stood on its hind legs. Small, assessing amber eyes. Something humble in its posture to balance the immoderacy of its size, the extravagant length of its curved, pale claws. It thumped back down, sending up a cloud of fresh snow, and shuffled off into the trees. She was not worth the trouble. She watched it go. She thought it might have been trout, come to remind her she was still alive. Barclay was sorry. After her bath, she had returned to bed, remained there through the night and into the next day. When he came to her, he drew her out of bed and knelt at her feet, pressing his forehead to her belly, the womb she believed she had locked against him. She stood with her arms at her sides and looked down on his bent head and the upturned soles of his shoes like an indifferent god. "When can I fly again?" she'd said. He gazed up at her, beseeching. "Do you forgive me?" She thought of Jamie begging her to take him away from Missoula. Still, she shook her head.
"You can fly when you forgive me," he said.
Red herrings. 13. The assistant director shushed everyone, the whole cast sitting at the big U-shaped table with our scripts and our sharp new pencils like kids on the first day of school, the surrounding scrum of bagel eating, coffee drinking production people and studio people and investors. And then Bart Olufsen stood up and peered down into his first edition hardback copy of Marion's book, not Carol's, which he clearly disdained, and read the opening aloud in his faint Icelandic accent. "Where to begin?" he intoned. "At the beginning, of course. But where is the beginning? I don't know where in the past to insert a marker that says, here. Here is where the flight began. Because the beginning is in memory, not on a map." He looked up and stared into our faces with grave intensity, almost accusingly, like a priest reminding us that we were sinners. I glanced at Redwood in the scrum. He looked solemn, earnest. It had been a week since the night of the shrooms, and I hadn't heard from him except for when I'd sent him a gif of two sloths floating in outer space with the text, "Us on shrooms talking about LA." He'd responded, "Ha! Here we find ourselves at a beginning, too," Bart told us. "We are about to make a movie. But this is not a big bang out of nothing." That moment Marion can't identify. When her flight began its trajectory toward reality, that was our beginning, too. In life, beginnings are not fixed but ambient. They are happening all the time, without us noticing. He tapped the book. "In here," Marion wrote, "I am already lost to my future." Strange words, yes? The first line of Carol Pfeiffer's novel is, "I don't know it, but I am about to be swallowed by either fire or water." It's supposed to be Marion's narrating as a baby on the sinking ship. Then the story runs straight forward in time until she crashes into the ocean. "The cold brings the darkness, and I am lost, but I am not afraid." That last sentence felt tacked on to me, a wishful, spluttering little protest. After Redwood told me his mother always wanted things to be fine, it made sense. She was trying to reassure herself. The movie, though, starts at the end, in the airplane, when they're running out of fuel and there's nowhere to go. Then it jumps back to the shipwreck and runs forward, with the round-the-world flight broken into parts and slotted in every once in a while, so finally we wind up back in the plane again at the end, when they crash. "I think about it like this," Bart said. "We are confined to the present, but this moment we're living now has, for all of history, been the future. And now, forevermore, it will be past. Everything we do sets off unforeseeable, irreversible chain reactions. We are acting within the constraints of an impossibly complex system." He paused and stared around again. "That system is the past," he said. I caught Sir Hugo's eye. He winked. "Bart says everything like it's the aha moment of a TED talk," I'd said to Hugo once. "It hypnotizes people into thinking he's a genius." "But his grandiosity lends everything a lovely sense of occasion, don't you think?" Hugo said. "But," Bart said, "sometimes beginnings can be simple. In a film, for example, the beginning is a single frame. Today, let us give ourselves the relief of containment, of limits. Let us begin on page one." He gestured to the assistant director, who had clearly been waiting for this cue, and leaned into his microphone. "Exterior, day," he read from the script. "A two-engined silver plane is flying over white-capped ocean, no land in sight. A faint trail of leaking fuel streams from under its wing. Marion, voiceover." "I was born to be a wanderer," I said, the amplified twin of my voice following a millisecond behind. "I was shaped to the earth like a seabird to a wave." That shroomy night by the pool, what chain reactions had Redwood and I set off? Not the ones I expected. I'd slept in his bed, but he never even kissed me. He'd said I should just crash here because we were too messed up to go anywhere and some company would be nice. He gave me the choice between his bed and a guest room, and I thought he was giving me the choice between hooking up or not, and I thought I was choosing to hook up. But when I emerged sexily from the bathroom in one of his t-shirts, he was already asleep. Around dawn, I think I woke up, and I think he was spooning me. But that might have been a dream, because when I woke up for real, He was in the kitchen making breakfast tacos. "I think you're great," he told me when I left, and kissed me below my ear. And who the fuck knows what that's supposed to mean? Maybe the problem was that we hadn't actually been in a beginning. Not starting a chain reaction, but still riding out an old one. I was still trying to escape my feelings for Alexei, my guilt about Oliver, hoping Redwood would turn out to be the key that freed me. Maybe he was hoping I was something equally improbable. We think each new romantic prospect, each new lover, is a fresh start. But really, we're just tacking into the wind, each new trajectory determined by the last, plotting a jagged yet unbroken line of reactions through our lives. That was part of the problem. I was always just reacting, always just getting buffeted along, never setting a destination. After I'd gotten home from Redwoods, I'd taken a green juice into the office where Augustina was working on the computer. She always seemed to be getting jerked around by men, so I thought she might have some wisdom. "What does it mean," I said, leaning in the doorway, "when you spend the night with a guy in the same bed but nothing happens, and as you're leaving, he kisses you here," I tapped my neck, "and says he thinks you're great." She grimaced. She couldn't help herself, then rearranged her expression into thoughtful neutrality. "He probably thinks you're great," she said. "Yeah," I said, thumping the doorframe twice like I was dismissing a taxi. "Thanks." "Remember your interview tomorrow," she called after me. I got in bed and looked at Alexei's Instagram, then Alexei's wife's, then Oliver's ex-wife's, then Jones Cohen's, then basically everyone's I'd ever slept with. I don't know what I was looking for. Not the selfies or beaches or children or sandwiches I got. I was laboring away, pulling up a huge heavy net full of red herrings. Maybe I was looking for the answer to what I should be looking for. I already knew I was going to text this guy Mark by the time I got around to his profile. I'd known him since my Katie McGee days. Once Santa Monica High School's premier drug dealer, he'd become an entertainment lawyer, handsome and discreet, never romantically attached or possibly just never constrained by his attachments. Not very interesting, but nevertheless an absolute pillar of self-assurance. I'd turned to him in times of need before. People say fuck buddy, like the concept is so edgy and clever. But I thought of Mark more as a human placebo. If I believed he would make me feel better, he did. No one was staking out my gate anymore. The paparazzi had lost interest. Abandonment stings, even when it means freedom. I sent Augustina home, and Mark glided up the driveway in his BMW and drank the fancy mezcal I poured for him and complimented my Marian haircut and took me to bed in his practiced, luxuriously confident way. And when he moved to leave, I asked him to spend the night. So when the writer from Vanity Fair showed up the next morning, Mark was still there, sunning himself on a raft in the pool, as conspicuous as one of those huge flamingo-shaped inflatables I'd seen in everyone's Instagrams. The article wouldn't come out for a few months, but when I saw the writer's gaze alight on him out the window, I could almost have dictated the eventual lead. "There's a man in Hadley Baxter's pool, a gorgeous man in sunglasses and itty-bitty trunks, floating on a raft. Just a friend," she says with a sly smile, leading the way through her Spanish-style home. "We've known each other since we were naughty little kids." In other words, Hadley doesn't need your pity. Hadley Baxter isn't back. Hadley Baxter never left. Of course, though, what I wanted was for Redwood to read that right then, right now, not in a few months. I wanted him to know his rejection, if that's even what it was, hadn't hurt. What would you say drew you to this role of Marion Graves? The writer asked when we were ensconced in my living room with canned seltzers and half glasses of white wine. Just a cheeky one, as my friend Hugo would say, Hadley says, referring to Sir Hugo Wolsey, her neighbor and a producer of Peregrine. I splayed sideways in an armchair. She was perched on the couch, her recorder on the coffee table. I'm sure you've done your research and know about my parents, I said. I've always been interested in disappearance. A lot of the time, maybe most of the time, when people disappear, it's actually literally death, but it's not perceived that way. There's an escape hatch built into disappearance. It is an escape hatch. Marion gets framed in the context of what really happened, like her never coming back is some unsolved mystery. But even if she turned into a Yeti and roamed Antarctica for 50 years, there's really only one upshot at this point. She'd be 100 years old now. Disappearance comes for us all, you know? I used to wonder if my parents might be alive, like if somehow they'd faked their own deaths. You can't help picking at things. A couple of years ago, I even hired an investigator, but he didn't find anything. He said he didn't think there was anything to find. Just a really big lake. Anyway, if they were alive, that would have meant they went to great lengths to abandon me. The writer blinked. She said, "What do you think now?" "Now it seems like they never existed at all." She nodded slowly, leaned even farther forward, asked, "Are you a searcher, Hadley?" "What do you mean?" "Let me put it this way. I think of a seeker as someone looking for enlightenment. I mean searcher as something more open-ended, someone who's actively trying to find their way." I looked out the window at Mark trailing his hand in the water. "Maybe I am," I said. "But not a good one, because I always seem to be a little bit lost." That was a nice pull quote for her. "I always seem to be a little bit lost." Something to superimpose in big italics over a photo of me styled to look rebellious but also waify. Leather jacket with no shirt underneath, heavy eyeliner, forlorn expression. She said, "And what about love? Are you searching for that too?" "I'm probably more likely to find enlightenment." "Is it possible they're the same thing?" "No," I said. "I think they're opposites." After the table read was over, after the assistant director had read "Fade to Black" into the mic as Marion sank into the depths, when everyone was milling around and congratulating each other, I sought out Redwood while pretending I wasn't. "Hey," I said, feigning surprise when we came face to face. "You do exist. I thought maybe I'd hallucinated you." He laughed nervously and tucked his hair behind his ears. "FYI, all those pink elephants were real too," he said. We could just pretend it was a normal business lunch and not an intergalactic journey, if you want. Quietly, glancing around, he said, "After you get drunk or high with someone, do you ever wonder if you made a total idiot out of yourself?" "No," I said. "I assume I did." He smiled, relieved. "You didn't at all, but maybe I did. To be honest, I don't really remember what we said." "Yeah, to me, that always feels like part of the problem." "Just assume everything you said was brilliant." "What if I have a nagging feeling most of it was ridiculous?" "Maybe we could do it again," I ventured, And just stick to wine? Yeah, he said, for sure. And he was about to say something else, but someone called him away.
Lodgings. British Columbia, June 1932, 3 months after Marion visited Missoula. The steerman crossed into Canada. Below, the world was green with new growth, and the wind blew easterly through the bright morning, rutting the sky and bouncing the plane. Marion banked west. Jamie was hunkered down in the front cockpit with his valise and his box of paints and brushes. Cases of whiskey would occupy that space on the way back. Marion would blame engine trouble for her delayed return. Say she'd had to put down in the wilderness, fix the plane herself. Barclay might not believe her, but at least by then her task will be done. Caleb had written to tell her that Jamie had not improved, that he kept talking about her taking him somewhere as though his departure was imminent. Might it be worth a try? Caleb thought he knew someone to rent the house, care for the dogs and Fiddler. Caleb never wrote unless it was important. Marion had told Barclay she forgave him, let him fuck her, willed her womb closed. She started flying across the line again, mailed two letters from a nowhere town. One was to Jamie, telling him to be ready, that she would come get him soon and without warning. The other was a query, though an unanswerable one because she instructed the recipient not to write back. She didn't want Barclay to see any letters coming from Vancouver. The only clouds were sparse and stringy, like shreds of sheep's wool caught on barbed wire. The propeller was a circular smudge, a transparent disturbance. Barclay had known what the price of forgiveness, even feigned, would be. Flight, of course. He gave it grudgingly, suspiciously. Knew each trip she made over the line was a pantomime of escape. In the front cockpit, Jamie gazed blearily down. He'd gulped a good amount of moon before they left, a last drink, he'd told himself, proud about recognizing his need to take a break from booze, smug about resisting the urge to smuggle a bottle along for the flight. If only Sarah could be in the plane, too. He imagined her interest, her delight in the landscape below. When he'd first returned to Missoula after Wallace left for Denver and Marion for Barclay, he'd missed Sarah so badly and so persistently that the sensation had scared him, and he'd fled into his work and into booze like a panicked elk fleeing into a lake to escape swarming flies. With his painting, he could summon her image. With his painting, he could show her, though he still didn't know what exactly. After nearly a year, thoughts of her no longer distressed him, but offered something like companionship, especially when he drank. He imagined long, rambling conversations with her, peppered her with questions she never answered. Marion descended into a long valley. Raw country turned into farmland that turned into neighborhoods. A city sprawled out under transiting cloud shadows, ending at the sea. As she bore to the north, across the harbor from downtown, Jamie picked out the small airfield that was the center of the circle around which they had begun revolving, drawing closer and closer as though a tether were being reeled in.
If you'd have let me write back, I would have warned you I only have my smallest room free.
Geraldine was for the most part as Marion remembered. Fair and soft and bosomy in a way that seemed maternal, reassuring, though her manner was more brisk and her gaze more skeptical.
That's fine, Marion said.
Is it fine with you? Geraldine said to Jamie. You're the one staying.
I'm sure it is.
You might want to look first.
He'd been quiet in the taxi from the airfield. Marion imagined he'd been feeling the beginnings of a hangover months in the making, or maybe absorbing the unfamiliarity of the place, the difficulty of starting over.
Go look, she told him,
though she knew he would not refuse the room.
While Geraldine took him upstairs, she waited at the kitchen table. She had last sat there only a year ago, the morning of the day she flew over the crevasse. Jamie and Geraldine were gone longer than she expected. The house seemed quiet. The other boarders must be out. She looked at her watch, thinking about how far she could get from Vancouver before sunset, where she might manage to spend the night without word getting back to Barclay. Laughter and footsteps, creaking stairs. When they came back into the kitchen, both of them seemed lighter and brighter than before, pinker. "Is it all right?" she asked Jamie.
"A palace," he said cheerfully.
"No guests," Geraldine said, suddenly stern, her brightness snuffed out. "Be in by midnight, and no drinking in the house."
"All right," Jamie said.
"Go unpack then," Marion said. "I'll wait here." When he was gone, Marion stood. "Will you tell him I said goodbye?" she said to Geraldine.
"You won't stay the night?"
"I can't. My husband is expecting me."
"Not even a cup of tea?"
"I can't." Geraldine looked at her with concern that was more practical than sentimental.
"Why couldn't I write back to your letter? Is your brother in some kind of trouble? You ought to tell me if he is."
"No, or nothing a change of scene won't fix."
"Are you in some kind of trouble?"
"It's a long story."
"About what?"
Marion had been moving toward the door with Geraldine following. "My husband, mostly."
"Ah." The woman nodded, her mouth in a twist that suggested she knew a thing or two about husbands.
"I don't like goodbyes," Marion said at the door. "Jamie knows that. He won't be surprised."
"I don't mind goodbyes," Geraldine said. "I'll pass along yours."
An incomplete history of the Graves family. 1932 to 1935. In May 1932, Amelia Earhart flies a Lockheed Vega from Newfoundland to Northern Ireland alone. The first solo Atlantic crossing since Lindbergh. A difficult flight, stormy and almost 15 hours long. Ice builds up on the wings. The plane spins down 3,000 feet. When she regains control, she is low over the Whitecaps. She might have disappeared then in a cold place without islands or atolls, where people couldn't dream her back to life, make her a castaway. They would have looked for her and found only water, as they did anyway, later. Probably she would have become just another dead pilot, briefly famous, lost in pursuit of a dream, now forgotten. Night in Hopewell, New Jersey. A baby's empty crib. A ransom note on the windowsill. Charles Lindbergh's first child, a son, 20 months old, is gone. Chaos. Uproar. Headlines as big as they go. Everyone's a sleuth. Everyone wants a piece of the action. From prison, even Al Capone offers to help. After 10 weeks and 1,000 false leads, after Lindbergh pays ransom to a man who promises his son is safe on a boat that turns out not to exist, the baby is found 4 miles from the Lindbergh house, skull fractured, badly decomposed, dead since the night he was taken. Lindbergh has always been quiet, truthfully, pretty weird. Once, as a prank, he filled a friend's water pitcher with kerosene, watched him drink. Lindbergh laughed until he cried. The friend went to the hospital. He turns further inward, peers out of himself through a narrow chink, a gap in the curtains. His wife, Anne, never sees him cry. Amy Johnson, of Britain to Australia fame, flies from London to Cape Town in a de Havilland puss moth named Desert Cloud, beating the solo record set by her own husband, Jim Mollison, a drunken, loud, and relentless philanderer, but a good pilot. The Saharan dunes ripple silver under a full moon. In August, Barclay finds Marion's replacement diaphragm. Lately, he's been penetrating her without fanfare, like an animal obligated to breed. But one night, trying to elicit pleasure to make her respond to him as she used to, he puts his fingers in her, feels the rubber rim. He strikes her across the face with an open hand, and she hits him back, fist closed. "If you go up in that plane again," he says, one hand over his watering eye, "I'll pour gasoline on it and light a match." "Then I'll do the same to myself." "You wouldn't. Are you sure? Where did you get it?" She won't say. His sister is no ally, but Marion won't betray her. He throws the diaphragm on the fire. After that, she is kept to the ground, where the air feels thick and heavy, her movements sluggish. Barclay mates with her grimly, daily. She doesn't think he makes her suffer out of hate. She thinks he believes pregnancy will come as a kind of cure, convert her entirely and immediately into the woman he thinks she should be, prove he's been right all along. He believes she will love him for his rightness. Sometimes he rages at her for lying there like a corpse, trying to make me feel wrong about it. He insists she has been with other men, makes insinuations about Caleb, about lovers scattered as widely across Canada as his caches of booze. He gets better at catching her wrists, dodging her blows. Herself, her interior habitat, once full of purpose, has become hollow and inert and uncanny, as though she is a hermit crab who has somehow mistakenly shed the inner animal instead of the shell. Her body grows hard, bony, thinner than she's ever been. He is heavy on her. The air is heavy on her. Weight and oppression are constant, uniform. Still, she is not pregnant. "I'm a witch," she tells him when he demands to know her trick. She sees he almost believes her in spite of himself. When she took him to Vancouver, she had told Jamie to send letters to the post office of a town she could visit between deliveries. But now, since she can't fly, she can't pick up her letters, and she doesn't dare write to him. She doesn't want Barclay to know where he is. One day in the fall, she walks far from the house. Clouds of round gold leaves shimmer on the aspen trees like a suspended rain of coins. A whistle, high and sharp. Caleb comes striding through the forest, the shimmer. He is as he always is, hair braided down his back, barrel of his rifle sticking up over his shoulder. He glints with humor, with the presumption of her love. In a rush, she realizes how lonely she's been. She wraps her arms around his waist. He curves a hand over her nape. She knows he is noticing, as her former barber, the raggedness of her hair. Barclay had wanted her to grow it long, so instead, she'd cut it herself, badly, with Mother McQueen's sewing scissors. She is talking into Caleb's chest. "What are you doing here? How are you here? Why are you here?" "Jamie said he hadn't heard from you."
"I haven't written. I couldn't. How is he?"
"He seems better. He's painting. I think he's betting his landlady. Here, see for yourself."
He pulls an envelope from inside his jacket.
"I'm just the messenger."
"You didn't walk all the way from Missoula, did you?"
"Not all the way. But maybe you and Jamie could look into more efficient ways to correspond. I've heard there's a postal service."
"You have to be careful not to be seen. Really, Caleb, not by anyone. Barclay won't like it. He's already taken away my plane."
"He's locked you up."
"Do you see me in chains?"
She doesn't know why she has the impulse to defend Barclay.
"It's not forever."
"It is, unless you leave him."
"He'll cool off."
Gently, he says,
I used to think my mother would get better.
That's different. She looks away, scanning the trees for spies. I'm sorry you had to come all this way just to deliver a letter.
It wasn't just for the letter. I wanted to see you. I was worried.
He studies her.
You're too thin.
She bristles, then subsides, feeling he has broken a promise to her by worrying, insulted her judgment and competence, but knowing, too, that she has given him good cause. He adds,
I'm always out wandering around. It's not a hardship to wander in this direction.
I envy your wandering.
Come with me, then. Leave.
There is no reason for her not to go except the impossibility of it. If I slink off, I'll feel like a coward.
Marion,
I need him to let me go.
He'll never do it.
Or else nothing will ever be resolved. I need a real end to it, an agreement of some kind. I can't feel as though I owe him anything.
You think he doesn't know how to make you always think you owe him something? Your marriage is a contest to him, and if he lets you go, he'll lose.
Heat rises in her. She can't tell fear from anger anymore. Don't argue, please. I can't bear it.
He yields. At least read the letter. I brought a pencil and paper so you can write back.
A twist of a smile.
You'd think I don't have anything better to do than be your personal courier.
In his letter, Jamie had thanked Marion for bringing him to Vancouver. He'd tried to reassure her that he was better, that the dark enchantment of Wallace's house had been broken. He expressed mortification for how low he'd sunk, for the state in which she'd seen him.
I let myself lose track of things.
He told her he'd gone to meetings of a local group of artists, the Boar Bristle Club, named for the hog hairs used to make certain paintbrushes. They'd included a few of his paintings in one of their exhibitions, and he'd sold one, not for much. On the weekends, he peddled portraits in the city parks like he had in Seattle, and he'd gotten a job in an art supply store, and he'd placed an ad in the newspaper offering drawing lessons.
The only fly in the ointment is that I don't hear from you and don't know how you are.
And, he added, he and Geraldine had become good friends. The truth? Jamie is in love, or not quite. He wants to be in love, because without question he is in lust. And not to love the first woman he sleeps with strikes him as impolite, even seedy. And why shouldn't he love the soft, welcoming body he is permitted to touch with his hands and his mouth, to rest his weight on, to venture inside? Why shouldn't he love the good woman who inhabits it, who has, through sheer carnal force, finally displaced Sarah Fahey from the center of his thoughts? There is no reason not to love Geraldine. And yet he doesn't.
Not quite.
But he feels affection for her, and whenever he is not in her bed, an eagerness to return to it. In Missoula, when he'd lost track of things, he'd been tormented by the knowledge that Sarah Fahey's life was continuing without him, that she would go to UW and meet a boy and get married and do all the things she was going to do anyway, even if he'd never shown up at all. In bed with Geraldine, he feels a vague sense of triumph, as though by making love to a different woman, he is taking some abstract retribution. But this feeling is even more impolite than the absence of love, and Jamie tries to quash it. What Sarah needs is forgetting. Geraldine tells him she is 30, and he thinks he believes her. Somewhere around there. She'd inherited the house from her mother. There are three boarders besides Jamie. An older man who is a retired teacher, a young man apprenticing with a tailor, and a single woman around Geraldine's age who works in an office and is always winking conspiratorially at Jamie. He is beginning to understand he is attractive to women.
Aren't you a tall drink of water? Said a woman in dungarees, picking up a large order of clay from the art supply store where he works. And when he'd asked, blushing, what that meant, she'd said, You'd be just the thing on a hot summer day. Later, he'd seen her again at a lecture put on by the Boar Bristle Club. Asked around a bit. Her name is Judith Wexler. She's a sculptor. Sometimes he worries Geraldine doesn't always remember he is just 18. Or, when he detects a trace of the maternal in her solicitous fussing, he worries she thinks of him only as a boy. But unease might be part of love, he speculates. Dear Jamie, I'm writing this from inside a stand of yellow aspens, where I came walking with no intention or expectation of meeting anyone, in fact, with the purpose of being alone, when who should appear but Caleb? He'd tracked me with the same stealth he uses on the elk, but kindly didn't shoot me. Not much to report except that I'm fine. Barclay won't let me fly, but I hope that will change. I have to hope. Anyway, please don't worry about me. Have you spoken to Wallace? I have, and he seems well enough. I'm glad you won't be following him to the doctor in Denver. Fresh starts, I suppose, are possible. Please keep writing, even if my replies are as anemic as this one. I'm not myself right now. It's 1933. Eleanor Smith, the teenage daredevil who flew under New York's bridges, marries at the age of 22, quits flying not long after, disappears from the scene. Quits flying, that is, until her husband dies in 1956. She will make her last flight in 2001, age 89, 9 years before her death. The pilot, Wiley Post, has one eye and a Lockheed Vega named Winnie May. He flies around the world, alone, the first to do it alone, in under 8 days with 11 stops. A northerly route. New York, Berlin, Moscow, a string of muddy towns in Siberia and Alaska, Edmonton, New York again. Not technically a great circle, but undeniably a big one. Post has two innovations on his side, a newfangled radio compass and a rudimentary Sperry autopilot. He can home in on radio beams to find his way, snatch catnaps in the cockpit. Still, he is so desperately tired. Amy Johnson and her husband, Jim Mollison, fly west across the North Atlantic against the prevailing winds, aiming for New York. They crash in Connecticut, but survive. In 1941, transporting a training plane to RAF Kidlington, Amy, 37 years old, will get lost in bad weather, bail out over the frigid Thames estuary, and either drown or get sucked into the propeller of the boat that tries to rescue her, her body never found. Bill Lancaster, an English pilot, crashes in the Sahara trying to break Amy's record to South Africa. His wrecked plane and dry brown twist of a body will lie undisturbed and undiscovered on the empty sand until 1962. Every day the turning earth lifts him to meet the dawn. Elsewhere, the world will destroy itself, rebuild. Hitler bullies and bargains his way to the chancellorship. When he gives speeches, his head snaps back as though his own words are punching him in the jaw. According to the Treaty of Versailles, Germany is never again allowed an air force. But German pilots have been training in secret in the Soviet Union. Not Stalin's best decision, this particular helping hand. Others are trained under the thin guise of civilian sports clubs, hardy young Aryans soaring in gliders through the fresh alpine air. More and more planes are built. Other flying machines, too. Airships, autogyros, flying boats. Records are made and broken for distance, speed, endurance, altitude. Marion hears little of this, as she seldom sees a newspaper at Bannockburn. More airlines spring into being. A United Airlines Boeing 247 explodes over Indiana. the first bombing of a passenger plane. No one ever figures out who did it or why. A great blankness settles in Marion. Never has she been so idle. She has no daydreams, no ambitions. Once in a long while, Caleb comes and finds her out on the ranch, startling her, carrying her old life on him like a scent. "Dear Marion, I have moved across the harbor to Vancouver proper. I'm afraid Geraldine and I didn't part on good terms. I disappointed her, but I could not have done otherwise. I am sorry about it, though." Jamie lives in a rooming house on a block of Powell Street, where unruly Gastown begins to subside into tidy Japantown. His accommodations are not a private home like Geraldine's, but a grimy three-story building between a billiard hall and a Japanese barber shop. Relief in the grit and anonymity of this new iteration of life, in the rowdy city bustle, the Gastown beer parlors and loggers' hiring halls, the clanging, whirring streetcars and huffing freight trains, the Japanese greengrocers and noodle counters, the inscrutable signs and chock-a-block window displays just to the south in Chinatown. Perhaps he might dip a toe into the nightlife. Perhaps, away from the dark influence of Wallace's house, he can have a few drinks and not lose track of things. Being free of Geraldine makes him miss her. But the missing feels dangerous, needs to be dispelled. He needs to be touched, needs new memories to lay over the old. A few bleary nights, a quick and queasy encounter with a prostitute. He paints street scenes, harbor scenes. Once a week, he gives drawing lessons to a rich widow, arranging still lifes of fruit and flowers for her to render with timid, fussy lines. He falls in with some other members of the Boar Bristle Club, all men in their 20s, most barely scraping by. Two teach at the art school. A few have had work in traveling exhibitions or won museum purchase prizes. They critique each other's work, but mostly they drink together. He asks them about Judith Wexler, and they tease him mercilessly. "She'd eat you for lunch. There be dragons, lad. Abandon all hope, ye who enter her." Without telling him anything of use. He writes to Marion, "I have a feeling I have reached a juncture full of consequences that can't be anticipated, but will later seem inevitable. Should I embrace a bohemian life as a temporary lark, or resist it as a trap? I'm afraid of being sucked under as Wallace was, as I nearly was. But to live without any fun at all seems too extreme a precaution, and also discouraging to the making of art. I want love, but not a wife. Not yet. I want drink, but not dissolution. I want momentum, but not to careen. I suppose what I want is some kind of equilibrium, but I suppose I want the thrill of tipping back and forth, too. Do you know what I mean? Maybe not. You've always been one for a single-minded pursuit. Maybe the answer is in painting. It's true that when I'm working is when I'm most at peace. Happy birthday." They are 19. Marion, by this time, is pregnant. Her monthly blood had been irregular for months because she has gotten so thin. But she knows, even so. Her breasts throb as though the skin might rip. She manages to hide her nausea from Barclay, knows she can't keep the secret for long. How stupid she'd been. How passive and superstitious and wishful and ridiculous. An earthbound ghost wandering among the trees, a breeding sow waiting in the bedroom. She had wondered, in spite of herself, if there might be some truth to Barclay's certainty that the moment of conception would convince her of her destiny as a mother. But instead, the meeting of sperm and egg had been the formation of that first ice crystal on the surface of a lake, from which a solid, unbroken pane blooms and feathers out to the encircling shore. She peers down through it into the black depths of herself. and does not hate the floating mode of life suspended there, but will not pity it either. No denying anymore that prohibition is bound to end. Barclay's associates have been coming to Bannockburn to discuss what to do. Cattlemen, he tells his mother, come to talk cattle.
They're bootleggers,
Marion whispers to Mother McQueen, leaning over her chair.
Your son is a criminal, as you well know.
But Mother pretends not to hear, hums as she knits. Barclay is loath to relax his surveillance of his wife and seldom leaves the ranch. But once in a while, business keeps him away overnight. Marion waits. She has no real plan, only her will, which has returned to her like a wayward hawk coming to the glove. One afternoon, Barclay and Sadler drive away, not to return until morning. She waits through supper with Kate and Mother. Waits beside the fire while Mother's knitting needles click away the seconds. Waits in bed through midnight, beyond midnight, until the silence feels settled. She creeps down the stairs, testing every footfall, certain the telltale house will betray her. The September night is warm and clear, with half a moon. She wears trousers, a plain shirt, a canvas jacket. She takes a knapsack containing a wool blanket, a water canteen, some food, a flashlight, a compass, a knife, and a stash of money she'd withdrawn from the bank in Missoula on her last visit and kept buried in a tin can near the airstrip. Everything else she thinks of as her own is in the cottage behind Wallace's house. Mrs. Barclay McQueen's fine clothes and jewelry, none of it has anything to do with her. The moon blues the ranch road as she crosses it, casts her shadow, blues the wings of the steerman. She'd thought Barclay might have disabled it in some way, was prepared to walk over the mountains. But after she pours in oil and cleans the spark plugs, the engine turns right over. When she discovers the gas tank is still half full, she trembles with anger and shame. He'd been so certain she wouldn't disobey him. She wishes she could go to Missoula, to Caleb, to her cottage. She wishes she could go to Miss Dolly's, to Mrs. Wu. But it is too much to hope that no one at the ranch will hear the plane take off, that anyone will be fooled by her note. In Missoula, she would be found before noon. A trundling rush along the bumpy ground in the dark. A parting. She banks over the moonlit mass of trees, turns northwest. The sky stays clear, but even the densest clouds would not have stopped her. Passing over the dark sheen of a lake, she takes off her wedding ring and drops it.
He doesn't know about the baby, Jamie says after Marion has told him the story.
The morning she left Bannockburn, she had landed the plane in the wilderness when it ran out of fuel. Concealed it as best she could by pushing it nose in among some trees before walking 10 miles to the nearest town. There, she'd spoken to no one except the board station clerk, who'd sold her a one-way ticket to Boise. She'd gotten off after 2 stations and bought a ticket to San Francisco, repeated the ruse once more, then stayed on a train to Vancouver.
No, she tells Jamie.
He doesn't know where you went, either?
I didn't tell him, and I'm almost positive he never knew I brought you here. He would have gloated and held it over my head. Still, he might show up sometime. I'm afraid he will, but I can't do anything about it. If he comes, just tell him you don't know where I went, which will be true.
I'm not afraid of him.
You ought to be. I'm sorry, Jamie. It's all my fault. They are walking beside Oppenheimer Park. On a baseball diamond, a team of Japanese men is practicing. Jamie points at them.
They're the best in the city. If you stay, we'll go to a game. Everyone comes out.
I can't stay long. Promise to be careful, will you?
What can Barclay take from me? I don't have anything.
You know it's not what he'd take.
I've always been afraid of exactly this situation.
Well, you shouldn't have stayed with him for my sake.
I didn't. I was paralyzed somehow.
What made you unparalyzed?
Getting pregnant. He hesitated. I can't have it, she says brusquely. I'd be tied to him forever. Even if by some miracle he never found out, he'd have gotten his way. An adoption is out of the question. I couldn't leave a baby to wonder about its parents. It's not an experience I'd recommend.
No, me neither.
He ushers Marion into a tea room. As they sit, she says, changing the subject, what did you decide about the bohemian life? A waiter brings a ceramic pot, two handleless cups.
I didn't so much make a decision as slide into an ongoing compromise.
This tea is green. What kind of compromise?
Try it, it's good. The compromise is that I'm living day to day without making any sweeping decisions.
Just live each day, was what Judith had told him to do when he confessed his anxieties. She'd shrugged her bare shoulders, sitting naked on her mattress, smoking a cigarette, unable to comprehend why he would worry so much. Don't decide anything. He has not yet told Marion about Judith, whom he is desperately in both lust and love with. Marion would not like Judith, would find her pretentious and self-absorbed, and he is not sure he wants to grapple with whether that view might be correct. Is that compromise? Marion says. It sounds a little bit like procrastination. You don't think you'll go back to being how you were before, do you?
No, he says thoughtfully. But the worry is always in the back of my mind. I think worrying acts as a kind of break. Anyway, I've been concentrating on painting. I've sold some in the club's exhibitions. And there's a photographer here, Flavian, he's from Belgium, who's opened a gallery and wants to sell my work.
That's good. She peers into her teacup. This tastes like plants.
Tea is plants.
If you sell another couple paintings, could you move out of that place where you're living? It looked like a flop house.
It is one, basically. But I don't know where else I would want to go. That's the problem. I might as well stay where I am and save the money. This way I can afford my share in the studio, too.
Can we go there? I want to see what you've been painting.
We'll go this afternoon.
He leans forward, lowers his voice.
But Marion, what are you going to do?
I can't have it, she says again. I would have gone to Miss Dolly's. There's someone there who could help. But Barclay would find out in no time. So I was thinking I'd ask at the brothels here until someone tells me where to go. When he thinks of Barclay, he feels the same fury as he had years ago, when he'd almost killed the boy who'd been throwing stones at that dog. The fury, logically, exists only within the confines of his mind, his body. But it seems so much bigger and stronger than he is. Elemental, something that might break him apart from the inside. He imagines Marion knocking at brothel doors, being sent to some disreputable doctor. A dark room, a tray of rusted instruments.
Barclay would kill you if he knew.
I don't think so. But even if I knew he would, it wouldn't change anything. What can he offer her? He knows nothing about the secret doings of women. He thinks of the prostitute he visited in Gastown. Can't imagine asking her for the time of day, let alone help in procuring an abortion for his sister. Judith might know, but he wouldn't trust her to keep a secret. Then a connection shunts into place in his brain so forcefully there's an actual physical sensation. I know someone. He pauses. Does he know her? The sum of his knowledge is small, but suggests she is capable and compassionate,
invested in this kind of problem. What if she turns Marion away, though? Then Marion will do what she is planning to do anyway. What if she has Marion arrested? She wouldn't. He thinks he knows that much, at least. You should go to Seattle, he says. I know someone there who might be able to help you. It's better than not knowing anyone. Marion goes to Seattle by train, in an ordinary traveling dress bought for its ordinariness, an ordinary hat to cover her short hair, plain shoes. She carries a new suitcase containing another such disguise, and also her old clothes, which serve as a talisman, a promise she will soon revert into her real self. She gives a false name when she checks into her hotel, Mrs. Jane Smith springing into existence.
You're just like your portrait, Mrs. Fahey says. They are